I'm very pleased to welcome you here to CSIS's Decision 2008 initiative. We have two different aspects of it. One is, and this is the second of that series, where we've asked the presidential candidates to come and have a chance for a more intimate one-on-one with people who are interested in national security matters. And the second is a series of debates and dialogues between Republican members of Congress and Democratic members of Congress over selected issues. I believe we've had one of those as well. As I said, this is the second of the series, and Duncan Hunter has gracefully agreed to come and present here. He was elected to California's 52nd District in 1980. He's a former Vietnam veteran, Army Ranger, served on the HASC since that time, was the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee from 2003 to 2007, is now one of the nation's leading voices on national security, defense, and military issues. I welcome Mr. Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. As I lose my voice as I take the podium, great to be with you this morning. And I thought that that what I would talk about a little bit, since I just came back from Iraq, is Iraq, because it's the order of the day. So rather than talk about a broad array of issues, I thought I might focus on Iraq, maybe focus on another issue that is prominent as a result of the president's trips to Central and South America, which is border control, and talk about those two issues, and then elicit any questions or comments that you might have on those issues. We went to Iraq and went to the two very difficult warfighting locations called Ramadi and Fallujah, which everyone has seen regularly in the news over the last several years. Those are in Anbar province, in a Sunni area, a place of enormous fighting during the last several years, and a location in Anbar province where a large proportion of American casualties have been taken. We then moved out of Fallujah, Ramadi to Baghdad and undertook a series of briefings there, focusing on the effects of the Baghdad plan, which involves the dividing of Baghdad into 10 sectors and the placing of Iraqi forces at least a brigade level in each one of those sectors, which is two or three maneuver battalions backed up in most cases by American forces at a ratio of about three Iraqi units to one American unit. Now, let me just talk about generally about my position with respect to the American presence, the operation, and the prospects for success. First, I think it's in our interest to expand freedom in this part of the world. If we can have I would define success in Iraq as having a nation that has a modicum of freedom for its people, that is a friend and not an enemy of the United States, and that will not be a state sponsor of terrorism over the next 5, 10, 20 years. That's my definition of success. And in standing up the Iraqi state, we've followed basically the same pattern that we've used many times in other nations, and that is, number one, to stand up a free government, number two, to stand up a military capable of protecting that free government, and number three, the American forces leave. Now, we're right now embarked on and undertaking that second very difficult stage of standing up the Iraqi forces. And what you see in Anbar province is quite interesting, quite different from the last time I was in Fallujah. And I can recall being there several years ago when my son was a Marine officer who was in the first battle of Fallujah. And I can recall that his fellow officers were telling me that we brought in a green Iraqi unit, Iraqi Army unit, to participate in the Battle of Fallujah. And the next day, when they were supposed to show up for their mission assignment, they had left. They basically took off. They were green troops, untrained, and they left. When we arrived at Ramadi in Fallujah this time, we were briefed by Marines right down to the corporal level, and their testimony was to the effect that the Iraqi army is standing and fighting, that they are now working, interestingly, a Shiite-led brigade of the Iraqi military is fighting side by side in Fallujah, undertaking military operations in Fallujah. that's Shiite-led brigade in partnership with Sunni-led National Police Force. And we were briefed by the police leadership and the military leadership sitting side by side, two communities which heretofore have been at each other's throats, or at least not working together, explaining to us through an interpreter how they are now working together along with the United States Marines. Now, this reflected a couple of things to me. Number one, it's still a tough, difficult challenge in Iraq, the standing up of this Iraqi military security apparatus that will be capable of protecting the country. But secondly, that General Portreyes has a team of very talented military leaders in Iraq right now. And I think of him as a manager of stars. That is, he's a manager of very, very talented people who in some cases, like the Marines out in Anbar province, are custom-making solutions, which can't necessarily be derived out of any military playbook, but are a function of smart commanders on the ground who understand the communities and understand what it takes to stand up the Iraqi military. So the Marines in Ramadi and Fallujah are putting together this solution, and the solution is largely a function of the fact that the al-Qaeda overreached, that they brutalized the population, they assassinated a number of the local tribal leaders and their families, and the hard edge of al-Qaeda has pushed a lot of the Sunni population in Anbar province over on the other side. And there are a number of the leadership now in Anbar province, according to our briefings, is in the majority now, opposing and resisting al-Qaeda. And the Marines have capitalized on that by bringing them together with the Iraqi Army. The 1st and 7th Divisions are in Anbar province. And interestingly, the local community now is sending forth lots of recruits, which they weren't doing in the past, which is really an excellent barometer of their feeling toward the Americans and toward al-Qaeda. They are now sending out a lot of their young people as recruits into the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police force, which before had not occurred. And I think that really is an indicator as to which side they're taking. We moved to Baghdad. A couple of facts were briefed to us, which I think were important. One fact was that the Iraqi army did show up, that the three brigades that Mr. Maliki promised did show up, are in place, and are working their mission in Baghdad. American forces are in a backup role primarily while they undertake special missions. They are in primarily a backup role and a mentoring role. And the embedded teams have been are being utilized extensively. That is, Americans who have logistical understanding and expertise and also have the ability, are connectors with American backup forces in case an Iraqi unit gets in trouble. So we're undertaking right now this difficult second phase, which is standing up the Iraqi military. And, you know, for those who would say, and of course, if you read the array of books which have been, which criticize the Iraq operation, one point that is brought up many times is the statement or the proposition that we should have kept Saddam Hussein's army in place and it was a big mistake not to keep his army intact. I think that's nonsense. Saddam Hussein's army had 11,000 Sunni generals. Now, what are you going to do with an army with 11,000 Sunni generals? You literally had enough generals to have squads of generals. And the idea that 11,000 Sunni generals are going to be honest brokers, which is what you need the army to be, and be professionals who will treat the populations with fairly, especially when you have a Shiite majority in this country, I think that's not something that would happen. And so the proposition we should have kept this army with 11,000 Sunni generals intact and somehow that would have been the smooth road to occupation is nonsense. I think the conclusion most Americans need to understand is, or the proposition most Americans need to understand is, in occupation there is no smooth road. It's occupation is tough on two parties. It's tough on the occupied country, and it's also tough on the occupying country. And I think that's been reflected in the mood in the United States, also reflected in among the population in Iraq. And we've seen that before. The same people who welcomed us with open arms when we took back Europe, and American troops would enter villages and towns and be greeted enthusiastically, that shine wore off after months of occupation when you had problems that arose with the local population and ended up with, in some cases, cases of resentment. And I can remember getting satellite cell phone calls from my son from Iraq saying, "Dad, you know, after you're here a while, you get an Army truck that goes down the road too fast. It hits somebody's animals. He now resents you. You have a have an altercation in the village, and you have some of your fire that has collateral damage. That could be somebody resisting right now." And so occupations, by definition, occupations are tough on the occupied country and the occupying country. But the stand-up of the Iraqi forces is proceeding apace. And in my estimation, we are succeeding in Iraq in that we're going to have a government which will hold, which will have a modicum of freedom for its people, will be a friend, not an enemy, of the United States, although that's never guaranteed. When a country achieves self-determination, then that's self-determination. But also a nation that will not be a state sponsor of terrorism. And having a nation that is so disposed in place of the nation that existed under Saddam Hussein will be a long-term strategic advantage, will offer a long-term strategic advantage to the United States in that region. So it's rough, it's tough, it's difficult, there's no smooth road, but in my estimation, we are succeeding in Iraq as long as we continue to stand up the Iraqi forces. Now, I made a recommendation to the president yesterday that I sent over to him, and I've already briefed this to Secretary Gates, which is simply this. The reason those brigades showed up in Iraq or in Baghdad is simply Mr. Maliki ordered them to do that, and he committed from the presidential level to do that. What I think we need to do is to build on that and to rotate every one of the 129 Iraqi battalions that exists, and we now have trained and equipped 129 battalions, to make sure that every single one of those 129 battalions gets a three-month combat rotation, if not in Baghdad, in a contentious zone in Anbar province or the Sunni Triangle or some other place where the battlefield affords a real opportunity for combat operations. Now, what that allows you to do is this: it allows the unit to move out to do all the things that are necessary to become an efficient, effective military unit. If you move into a three-month operation, you have to exercise your logistics chain, be able to feed your troops, supply your troops. The leader has to have his chain of command from his company grade and field grade officers right down through the squads of corporals and sergeants. It gives you unit cohesion. You have to fight together, operate together, and you become more effective in terms of combat effectiveness. In short, there is no substitution for real operations. That's why we send our people out to places like Fort Irwin to undergo extensive operations that are very similar to actual combat. Well, in Iraq, we've got lots of actual combat, and we've got 129 Iraqi battalions, some of which have operated extensively. Others have very little in terms of battlefield experience. So over the next 6 months, and I gave sent to the president a sample rotation schedule, let's make sure that we get every one of the 129 Iraqi battalions rotated through a combat operation. Three-month operation in which they have to move out, they have to fulfill a mission of sweeping, blocking, operating, and at the end of that, what you've developed is battalions that have a history of reliability, and that means that you have set the stage for American forces to rotate off the battlefield. And when you, in the past, when we rotated an American unit out of an area of operation, an AO. With the understanding that an Iraqi unit would rotate in many cases the Iraqi units did not show up, did not rotate in. You have to have a reliable force that is going to rotate in and displace the American forces on the battlefield. Once we have proven up, if you will, by combat operations, the battalions of the Iraqi army, at that point you've set the stage for American ground forces to rotate out of their combat roles in areas of operation and rotate in Iraqi forces. So that's a recommendation that I've made to the president, and I think that's the way to quickly stand up now the Iraqi army. Now let me go to just one other area, and then I'd be happy to take questions, and that's the border. You know, and before we built the border fence in San Diego, we had a no man's land that existed between Tijuana and San Diego. In fact, it was so bad that Joseph Wambaugh wrote the best-selling novel Lines and Shadows about that no man's land in the coastal hills between Tijuana and San Diego, in which armed gangs roamed every night, robbed and accosted the people that were coming across the border illegally. Sometimes they carried automatic weapons. They were extremely brutal. They moved back and forth across the border with impunity. And it got so bad that the city of San Diego developed a plainclothes police force led by a Sergeant Lopez who dressed like illegal aliens. And they would go down and wait at night at the border and wait to be accosted by these armed gangs. They went down to protect the folks that were getting brutalized who were coming in illegally. And when they were so accosted, which they regularly were, they would draw their weapons and there would either be a shootout or a series of arrests. And it's well described in Wambaugh's best-selling novel, Lines and Shadows, and I would commend that to anybody who claims that having an open border is desirable for any nation. But that's the open border that we had before we built the border fence. Well, I sent my staff out in those days in the late 1980s to find this landing mat steel that was in surplus at various bases around the country and around the world. And we searched every base from Guam to Guantanamo, and we found 79,000 pieces of surplus steel. These are steel planks that are 10 feet long, 2 feet wide, and about a quarter of an inch thick. And we got the Army Reservists to come in under our anti-drug program, because at the same time the border gangs were besieging the border, you had 300 drug trucks a month simply ramming across the sagebrush, coming across the border, coming up to our Highway 5 or 805 and getting lost in the traffic and heading out with their cargo of cocaine or marijuana. About 300 a month was the estimate. So we got the Army Reservists down to the border, and we built this primary fence. We absolutely stopped, obviously, the drive-through drug people, although several of the drug trucks actually rammed the steel fence, which showed that they didn't recruit the most intelligent drivers, just persistent ones. But they understood they couldn't go any further. And so we cut off the drive-through drug folks, and we started to reduce the smuggling of people and narcotics dramatically. Now, we asked one of our national laboratories, Sandia National Laboratory, whose scientists spend most of their time designing nuclear weapons, we asked them, how do you think we can enforce the border against smuggling? And these very smart people thought about it long and hard, and they came up with a profound answer. They said, how about a fence? And so they recommended a triple fence. They said, what you have to do if people are smuggling across the border, you have to have a physical impediment that delays them long enough for a fairly small cadre of border patrolmen to catch them. So they said, what you need is three layers of fence, and they sent us a design. So you had a primary fence on the border, which we then had with our steel landing mat. You then had a border patrol road that was 50 meters or so wide. Then you had a high fence with an overhang, a second border patrol road, and a third fence. When the Republicans took control of Congress in 1994, I wrote a fence provision mandating the construction of the San Diego border fence, a triple fence in San Diego, and designated that it had to stretch from the ocean the first 14 miles to the coastal hills. And we passed that. The Clinton administration did not like it. They didn't want to build it. So we had a meeting in which they said, we have to build all three layers of fence. And I said this. I said, I'll tell you what. Let's keep the law in the books, three layers of fence, but we'll just build two layers, the primary fence, the road, and the second fence. And if we don't need the third layer, we won't build it. We've never needed it. The double fence in San Diego has reduced the smuggling of people and narcotics in that area by more than 90%. And those are hard statistics. Similarly, or along the same line, since we built the border fence, by FBI statistic, the crime rate in the city of San Diego has dropped by more than 50%. And I believe the precise figure is 53%. Because you had a large criminal population that was moving back and forth across the border with impunity. If you look at the police records in the old days, we averaged 8 to 10 murders a year. Those murders were down, the last time I looked, they were down to zero. That meant, and the border gangs we put out of business. And the way we put the border gangs out of business was this. Their refuge, their safe haven, was the border. If they were pursued from the north, they simply stepped across the line. They went south. Pursued from the south, which at some point, sometimes they were, by the Beta Group, they would step across the line to the north. When we built the double fence, that destroyed their mobility. And as a result, put them out of business for practical purposes. Today, people can go down to the border where we built the border fence, and they can be there at night, which people never would do before. And the signals that I've gotten from talking to border patrolmen is that both sides of the border like the idea that the border gangs are gone. The northern neighborhoods of Tijuana like the idea that the border gangs are gone, as do the folks in South San Diego County. Now, this year, I drafted language that we put in the Homeland Security bill that mandates the extension of the San Diego border fence for 854 miles across the smugglers' routes of Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. It mandates it, and it gives certain times when it has to be done. There are certain humanitarian elements that we put in there, because one thing that we realized was there's between 200 and 300 people dying a year in the Arizona deserts primarily of a heat prostration and dehydration. What happens is the smugglers will take a group of people, they'll take them to the border, they'll tell them that the road's a mile to the north, in some cases it's 20 miles to the north, and at 10 o'clock the next day, if they cross the border at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, it's 105 degrees in July, and you have people that start hurting and start dropping. Well, we put in a recommendation or put in a mandate. There's no recommendations in the border fence bill. It's all mandate. We put in a mandate that before the hot season, that's this May 31st, which is coming up very quickly, the Department of Homeland Security has to have interlocking cameras on the corridor between Calexico, California, and Douglas, Arizona, which is approximately 392 miles. The border fence has been commenced by the Department of Homeland Security. They've started it in Yuma, Arizona. I called them up the other day. I said, how many miles you got done? They said, a mile and a half. I said, you got 862 and a half to go. And they're proceeding very slowly. And one of my pledges is when elected President of the United States, if that border fence is not finished, I'll finish it in 6 months. And very simply, you give one contractor mile one to mile three. You give another contractor mile three to mile five. This isn't complex. It's just a fence. And you all start working at the same time, and you can build the fence rapidly. When we build the fence, that's going to save lives. It's going to save lives of people that come across and expire in the desert. It's going to save the lives of Americans who have been hurt, physically hurt, by this population of folks, criminal aliens, who move back and forth across that 2,000-mile border. And right now, in federal, state, and local penitentiaries and jails, there is a population of criminal aliens of 250,000 people. It's a quarter of a million folks. And we spend, incidentally, just under $3 billion a year incarcerating those people. So for people that say the border fence is too expensive at $3 million a mile, which is what we spent on the first 9 miles of border fence, and obviously if you build 854 miles, you're going to be able to build it cheaper than when you do simply a 9-mile section. But that's... At $3 million a mile, you can build 1,000 miles of border fence for $3 billion. We spent right at $3 billion this year to incarcerate the criminal aliens who come across that border because there is no fence. So we would save enough money in 1 year to pay for the construction of the border fence simply in incarceration costs, not to mention the costs in terms of human suffering, that this fairly large army of criminal felons have extracted against the people of the United States. So we need to build a fence. We need to have enforcement. And I think since 9/11, border enforcement is no longer primarily an immigration issue. It's now primarily a security issue. We have to know two things. Who's coming into our country and what are they bringing with them? And you're not going to know that until you have an enforceable border where people have to knock on the front door if they want to come into the United States. Right now, we don't have that. In 2005, we interdicted 155,000 people. And these are the people we caught. 155,000 people coming across the border from Mexico who were not citizens of Mexico. They came from virtually every country in the world. 1,100 of them came from communist China. So everybody in the world has a television set today or has access to one, and they see that the way that you get into the United States illegally is no longer to come through the airports. Those loopholes have been blocked. The way you get in illegally is to get to Mexico and then come across the land border between Mexico and the United States. So I thought I would discuss those two security-related issues, and rather than go through a broad gamut of issues, but I'd be happy to take questions on any issue. And why don't we start off and let everybody have a chance to ask questions? And tell you what, why don't we start, since this lady in the back's got her hand up, why don't we start in the back and we'll just come on up and I'll let everybody have a chance for questions. Is that okay, Clark? I mean,
you
I don't want to.
Everybody have a chance as long as it's within 10 minutes.
Okay. Okay. Let's go. And I'll try to make quick answers here. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. As far as the border is concerned, are you finding any evidence at all that this smuggling of Al-Qaeda components or foreign terrorism components?
Are you talking about across our borders?
Yes, sir.
I haven't seen any reports of Al-Qaeda being smuggling, but here's what I would say, that I think Americans need to use their common sense. There is a strong and efficient network of smuggling operations now along the southern border in Mexico. It's a multi-million dollar per night business. The same smuggler, I think the Americans simply need to ask themselves this question. If you have a smuggler who will take $5,000 to smuggle a large number of people across the border, and he will take $5,000 to smuggle a large amount of cocaine across the border meant to destroy our children, will he in good conscience refuse somebody who wants to come across the border for other purposes, that is, for terrorist purposes? And the answer I think that every American would give is no. Money is money, and these smugglers who are moving contraband across the border in exchange for money, and it's a bloody business. As you probably know, in Nuevo Laredo, there's 600 unsolved murders right now, most of them drug-related. And a law enforcement officer in Nuevo Laredo who states that he's against the drug trade has a very short life expectancy. And so this is a bloody, tough business conducted by people who are very brutal and ruthless with no conscience. So if you ask yourself the question, if somebody at some point wanted to smuggle in something that would be considered to be a terrorist-related, would those smugglers refuse to do it on the basis that their conscience hurt them? I think the answer is no. They will smuggle anything for money, and that poses a danger to the country because that means you don't simply have an open border. You also have an apparatus in place south of the border, which is very efficient and is run by people who are very smart, who move things and people across the border for money. And that is obviously, that apparatus is not discerning as to who engages them. So that's my answer. Anybody else in the back row? Okay, all the way across in the back row? Okay, coming up the next row. Anybody in this row? Yes, sir, right here, and then I'll get this gentleman.
Congress has been outspoken on climate trade issues, defense industrial issues. I wonder, as you're traveling around now as a presidential candidate, what kind of reaction you're getting on those issues?
You know, I'm getting a great reaction on industrial trade issues, and it's very simply this. We've made a bad deal with China, and China is cheating on the deal that we have. It's not a good business deal. It's a deal that was done by poor businessmen. And very simply, it's this. If this podium was made in China, and it cost $100 to make, and it's moved to the shores to be exported to the United States so we can have a nice conference at which, in which guys like me can come in and criticize China. If it's $100 and it gets to the it's made in China and it gets to the shore to be exported to the U.S., the government of China gives back to the manufacturer their taxes. They rebate their taxes to them. They get, in this case, they do. They have a value-added tax system, a VAT system, so they give them essentially a cashier's check for $17. That company now has only $83 invested in this particular piece of merchandise. If a similar piece of merchandise is manufactured in the United States and sent for export to China, and this is the agreement we signed and agreed to, when it gets to China, China gives our manufacturer, the U.S. manufacturer, a bill for $17. So if we had $100 invested in our piece of furniture, it's now $117 in cost. So theirs has gone. We both started with a base of 100. Theirs went down to 83. Ours went up to 117. Now, just to make sure the American manufacturer never wins the competition, China then devalues its currency by 40%. That's cheating. And even Mr. Bernanke has said so in so many words. He wrote a speech when he made his last tour to China in which he said, your currency devaluation amounts to a subsidy. He used the word subsidy. Before he gave the speech to the Chinese leadership, somebody on his staff, or he pulled the word subsidy out of the speech because that's a key word. Subsidies under the GATT regimen are not allowed, as you know. And that and they trigger a series of actions that can be taken by the American government. So if you take those advantages that China has before there's any competition on labor or cost of components or materials, we've set up a trade regimen. We've agreed to a deal that is a formula for movement of the American industrial base, manufacturing base, to China. And you have advisors, business advisors in this country telling their companies, even if you have highly proficient labor and you have total modernization and tooling and you're doing everything right, it makes sense for you from a tax and tariff standpoint to move to the place where you're going to get all your taxes back. Now, if we say under this regimen, we want to pass a new tax law that allows us to rebate our corporate taxes from our corporations, our exporting corporations to them, just like you rebate your taxes in China, that's illegal. We signed a deal that said they can do it, we can't do it. So it's like you and I having a manufacturing plant on each side of the street. You operate tax-free and I pay taxes. Over the long term, assuming that all other factors are equal, who's going to win? That's the problem. It's a bad trade deal. We need to junk that deal, just like Ronald Reagan junked bad arms control deals. The Chinese will come back to the table because they will follow the consumer, and America has a consumer. This gentleman right here.
Congressman, you spoke articulately about securing the border. Could you tell us about how you view dealing with the 10 or 12 million undocumented people in the country and how that compares to the president's proposal?
Sure. You know, I haven't seen the latest. I know the president discussed his plan to some degree while he was on this trip, and I simply haven't had a chance to analyze the latest iteration. But here's what I would say. Right now, you've got we have a situation in which we, in fact, do deport thousands of people on a monthly basis from this country. And every time an American president talks about amnesty, that is allowing people who otherwise would be deported to stay, every time that's brought up in a speech, generally, historically, we've seen a surge of arrests at the border, meaning that human nature being what it is, people think that there's a benefit to be derived in the United States, to be obtained in the United States. The human nature is to get in under the wire, to get in before the door closes, and that's why there's a rush for the border. I think it's exactly the wrong thing for us, before we enforce our border, to undertake a legislation which is going to give some benefits and some path legality to people who have come here illegally. It absolutely works against our interests of having a secure border. We've now sent 6,000 National Guardsmen down to the border to buttress that thin green line of border patrolmen, which is very understaffed as it is. And the idea that at the same time we produce a magnet in Washington, D.C., that will tend to overwhelm this defensive line that we're trying to establish makes no sense. So I would say this. When you come to the United States, you need to knock on the front door. And if you're here illegally right now, there's nothing wrong or illegitimate about our country saying you need to go home, and then you need to knock on the front door. That's what I think we should do. So that's the if your question is, do you think we should have amnesty? Answer is no. And if you think do you think we should have a path to amnesty and start legislating that? The answer is no.
One more question.
Yes, sir, right here. Looks like we got one, didn't we?
Hey.
Okay. Let me tell you what I did last year. We had in the springtime, as we were putting the budget to bed, the Army and Marine Corps came in and told us. I was then chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and incidentally, Ike Skelton, who is replacing me as chairman, a great guy. We worked together, and the Armed Services Committee has an excellent chairman, a really good chairman. But the Army and the Marine Corps came in and said, "We have a massive reset problem that's not addressed in the budget. We got a lot of broken stuff that needs to be refurbished." So I directed our staff to set hearings, many of them closed hearings, with the Army and the Marine Corps, and here was my direction. I said, you elicit from the Army and Marine Corps every single dime that they need to reset every single piece of the force. Every one. Bring them in. And they came in, and they laid out line by line what they needed. I said, add it up. We added it up. I said, okay, how much of that is paid for by the base budget? And some of it was embedded in the base budget. And we said, how much of it is paid for by the supplemental that we'd passed, right? And some of it was paid for by the supplemental. And we had something that I started a couple years ago called the Bridge Fund. We did that on the authorizing committee, this $50 billion Bridge Fund, to get us through the late calendar months in the warfighting theaters. And I said, how much of that is paid for by the Bridge Fund? When you deducted out what was already embedded in the budget and the supplemental, we had a residual cost of just under $20 billion, and my direction to the staff was authorize every dime. They authorize, and are we going to cut it back 20%? Are we going to take things off? Authorize every penny. They did. We authorized every penny of it. It was right at $20 billion. The appropriators followed us, and the Senate followed us. And we did that. Now, I got after the Army in November because I checked on them, and they hadn't obligated much of that money. They had, I think, $3.8 billion obligated at that point. They came in and protested that they were obligating as fast as they could, and also they need carcasses. That is, if you've got a Humvee in Iraq and it's being used in Iraq, you don't have it available to be thoroughly repaired and renovated, right? So then that was a problem that both the Marines and the Army had. But we work this on a weekly basis, and they are proceeding, according to them, proceeding apace. One thing that I had our team do, we had a great industrial team in the Armed Services Committee. And staff director has been a CEO of a major aerospace corporation, so he understands industry. I said, go out, check on the depots, and let's make sure we've got headroom, got capacity in the depots to do this reset. Most of the depots were operating under 60% capacity before we developed this reset. But that's what we did, every dime. And the only thing that's going to detract from that effort will be the bureaucracy, and also the legitimate non-availability of some pieces of equipment that simply have to come out of theater before they're reset. But that's something we can do. You know, fixing things in depots is not rocket science. It's just something you have to do, and you have to steadily work on it. And what I want to do is make sure that fire engine is ready to go to the next fire, because after we leave Iraq, we're going to have other fires. We're going to have a difficult, dangerous world for the foreseeable future, and we need to be able to respond to those fires. So folks, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Good to be with you. Okay. Now off to more fun and frolic.